Support for Tested comes from Duke Health, reminding listeners that COVID-19 vaccines are safe, effective, and can protect individuals and others from the virus. Together, communities can end this pandemic. Find sites for a free vaccine at dukehealth.org.
Hey there, Jeff here again. We are rolling along with our politics podcast series on redistricting. Remember, it's called Behind the Lines. This week, we're looking at extremism and the prospect of reform. Hope you enjoy.
I want to see seats be competitive, even if it means that my preferred candidate doesn't win every time.
You know, it's exciting over here in the mountains. It's really exciting.
So people went to bed one night, moved from the most competitive to the most Republican district in the state of North Carolina.
My friends, I will tell you right now that there is a new Republican Party rising.
Has gerrymandering pushed candidates to their political extremes?
The public gets it. It's pretty overwhelming. They recognize it. Legislators shouldn't be picking their own constituents. It's the other way around.
Could redistricting reform actually gain any traction in Raleigh?
Of course, I would like to see an independent commission. And that's to everybody's benefit, whether they're conservative-leaning or liberal.
And why is a well-established gold standard potentially cracking?
I think this is the year that we might see what's wrong with Iowa's system or what doesn't work. They really have not said, at least not publicly, anything about wanting to change the system.
This is Behind the Lines. Let's begin in 2010. That's when Republicans carried out a national plan to reshape the electoral landscape. It was called REDMAP, an acronym for Redistricting Majority Project, and the strategy worked. Nationwide, the GOP picked up nearly 700 legislative seats and 20 state chambers. Two of those were here in North Carolina.
All of you are going to remember that you were in this room on November 2nd, 2010, because this is the night the Republican Party made history.
11 years ago, Republicans took back both bodies of the North Carolina General Assembly, and soon thereafter, got to cultivating new district lines, more friendly for Republicans. Then, in the next election in 2012, North Carolina's congressional delegation flipped, going from 7 Democrats and 6 Republicans to 4 Democrats and 9 Republicans.
So perhaps the best example of that would be actually my neck of the woods out in the 11th Congressional District.
This is Chris Cooper, professor of political science and public affairs at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee. That's in Jackson County. The district he lives in is 300 miles west of the state legislature.
The 11th is represented by a guy named Heath Shuler, who was and is a conservative blue dog Democrat. It was the most competitive district in the state of North Carolina. After the redraw, it became the most Republican district in the state of North Carolina. The city of Asheville was drawn out of the district. Shuler decided not to run again. A guy named Mark Meadows runs in a crowded field, and the rest is history.
From Shuler, a rare elected breed, this mountainous seat went to Meadows. As a member in the U.S. House, Meadows helped form the Freedom Caucus, which led a political insurgency resulting in government shutdowns and ultimately the ousting of then U.S. House Speaker John Boehner. Then, a few years later, after Meadows became President Donald Trump's chief of staff, a 25-year-old emerged from another crowded primary field to fill Meadows' seat.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Congressman Madison Cawthorn.
And although Madison Cawthorn has spent less than a year in office, he has already created too many controversies for us to list off here, and was also front and center stage for an insurrection.
There is a new Republican Party on the rise that will represent this country, that will go and fight in Washington, D.C. I'll tell you, I see so many of my friends who are up in Congress with me who are about to go back to that Capitol Hill. And at 12 o'clock today, we will be contesting the election.
We talk about the impacts of redistricting and gerrymandering, and I think we try to focus on a number of entities. But as we think about conservative Democrats, what did the 2011 round of redistricting mean for the Heath Shulers, either of Western North Carolina or of throughout North Carolina?
You know, I think it mattered in some pretty critical ways, right? Because we just had fewer and fewer competitive districts. So what happens when you try to gerrymander, and, you know, Democrats doing it in, say, Maryland, or the Republicans doing it in North Carolina, the same process works. You try to cram or pack as many of the opposition's voters into as few districts as possible. You need one more vote than the other person to win. Everything past that is sort of a wasted vote. And so the idea is, yeah, you cram, you spot them a few districts, and then you win the other districts by safe, but not as large margins. And so what that does is it can crowd out the folks who might be, you know, the conservative Democrats, the more liberal Republicans, the folks closer to the middle. There's also bigger historical trends at play there, but certainly redistricting added fuel to the fire.
Extremism.
Yeah.
Is redistricting a low-lying factor in political extremism that we've seen in this country? Is it a contributing factor? Is it the biggest reason? How do you enter redistricting into this equation of where we are currently with hyperpartisanship and a level of extremism in American politics?
I think it's certainly part of it, right? I mean, if we're reducing the number of competitive districts, I think you are going to naturally lead to more extreme candidates. Is it the cause? Is it the leading cause? You know, I'm not sure. But it is definitely part of, you know, it is a key ingredient of the stew that makes up today's polarized environment.
Practically, what has been the change from Shuler to Meadows and then Cawthorn for the constituents of Western North Carolina, thinking about the professor at Western Carolina, the Duke Energy employee, and just a rank and file constituent? What practically has changed just because their congressperson changed?
Yeah, I mean, I think everything about our nature of representation. Now, look, obviously, a lot of folks may be happy with this change, right? If you're a Republican, get rid of Shuler and getting in Meadows or Cawthorn may be viewed as a great thing. But the policies that they espouse shifted. Also, relationships shift. And I think this is one thing that maybe doesn't get enough attention in the redistricting conversation is, you know, the relationship you have with a member of Congress or a member of the General Assembly or your city council, a county commission. It's a relationship like any other. After a while, you know how to get in touch with somebody. After a while, you know when to trust them, you know when to question them. And the redistricting process, for good and bad reasons, disrupts that relationship.
Asheville, the urban center of the 11th district, was cracked or split so that a reliably blue constituency was spread out across two congressional districts, its collective voice diluted. As for the 2011 map that resulted in a Meadows victory, it was challenged in federal court, eventually going all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The congressional districts were declared unconstitutional and redrawn 5 years later. If you have yet to hear the first two episodes of this series, please consider doing it. We got into some of those court challenges and also some of these redistricting terms.
I think we've been very blessed. We have incredible representation in Congressman Cawthorn. We had it in Congressman Meadows. We've got great representation at the General Assembly.
Michelle Woodhouse is the NCGOP 11th Congressional District Chairwoman and a cousin to Dallas and Brad, well-known political operatives in North Carolina and D.C. The district borders Tennessee, Georgia, and South Carolina, and it's also the whitest in the state, at nearly 86%.
The 11th Congressional District is unique in that we're landlocked by other states, so the way that our map can be drawn becomes a little more challenging. We have small rural counties, and we're trying to balance out population. So because of the way our population is dispersed around this state, there are some challenges that they face in drawing these maps.
After the district was redrawn in 2016 and then again following a different legal challenge in 2019, Asheville was restored entirely within one district. Woodhouse actually calls that a positive move, She notes the deepening crimson swath around Buncombe that has helped to solidify the Republican nature of this seat.
I think conservatives were concerned about it. Liberals had been calling for it, and I think it still kept the congressional district obviously red. We have a Republican representative.
But of course, there are many who disagree.
I'd like to see a representative that felt like they had to come by.
Rich Lee is an Asheville resident who has unsuccessfully run for the city council 3 times.
Mark Meadows and I didn't see eye to eye on a lot, but he would show up at places where people were talking about local issues here in Buncombe County and at least state his case and listen to other people's cases. And it feels like we're so far beyond that now with the way our politics has gone that, you know, I don't know where I could find Madison Cawthorn to raise an issue with him if I wanted to. He's on the other side of the state or, you know, wherever the culture war is happening.
Lee blames this in part on polarization and partly on non-competitive districts. And he worries where it could go next.
You know, you think, well, who is going to make a good challenge for Madison Cawthorn? When these races come down to just the primaries, primaries don't usually go in the direction of more establishment or more, you know, more moderate candidates. You know, the only person who could beat Madison Cawthorn is to the right of him. And, you know, you think maybe like, well, there isn't room to the right of him. Well, there is, of course. There's always room to the right. Or there's always room to the left if you have a seat that's really gerrymandered to be Democrat dominated. And so these really lopsided districts also really, they work in the favor of more and more extreme candidates.
But do constituents have to settle for what they've presently got? Is it possible to change the rules of redistricting?
I started out in my freshman year being supportive, and I ended up the leader of the pack in the House.
Chuck McGrady is something of a unicorn in North Carolina politics, a political conservative environmentalist who served 5 terms in the state House, retiring in 2020. McGrady ascended to become a lead budget writer while leading an effort to modernize regulations for breweries and also championing redistricting reform.
It ranked high in terms of hours I spent on it, particularly in the last few years. At a point in time when I had firm commitments that the issue was going to be taken up, the legislature suddenly had to shut down and turn very quickly to addressing COVID and its financial implications. So, you know, it got killed off by the bug.
Spell out for us a little bit more clearly, how close were we to getting a more thorough debate and possibly a vote, at least in the House, on redistricting reform in 2020?
We were very close. As we ended 2019, the House held a full committee hearing on 3 or 4 of the bills that had been introduced. Unfortunately, in March of that year, 2020, all that changed. And I actually, aside from speaking with my leadership, I mean, I had a conversation with Senator Berger, the pro tem in the Senate, who, while indicating he wasn't at this point supportive of the legislation, he did think it was something that needed to be discussed.
So there is independent redistricting. There is nonpartisan reform. There are panels. There are a number of ways to do this. Succinctly, and I realize it probably had different iterations over the years, but succinctly, what did you propose when you were an elected official?
Well, I started out proposing what was the Iowa model, which created a way of redistricting that was clearly nonpartisan, had worked in Iowa for some period of time. It was statutory, though. And one of the concerns about a statutory fix is that, you know, the legislature can come back and change it. So over the course of the time I was in the General Assembly, in my last term, I was actually the lead sponsor of a constitutional amendment on the issue, while at the same time being one of the primary sponsors on the Iowa model.
Do you have a term that you've used nonpartisan a couple times? I think independent is a little bit of a misnomer, but how do you coin this up when you're talking?
Yeah, I don't know how you make something independent if you're going to have some group of people vote on, choose who the committee is. I try to go with nonpartisan. The reason I do that is because I think the key in any process is to figure out how to limit some of the political information that is now available to anybody who is putting together maps. You know, it used to be everybody paid a lot of attention to what you're registered as, but it's much more sophisticated than that. If you have access to what people are reading, what news programs they get, what organizations they've belonged to, you can probably get even a better read on whether they lean Democratic or Republican than whatever their voter affiliation might be on the election rolls.
What are the biggest pitfalls to some form of redistricting reform?
Well, I mean, the pitfalls is the politics. You know, I was around in the 2010s and the 2000s. In the 2000s, the Republicans in North Carolina, for example, were all about redistricting reform. They were in the minority, and they were locked out of, to some large degree, the redistricting process. Lo and behold, an election occurred, and the Republicans were now in the majority. In the first term, the House was able to pass a nonpartisan redistricting bill, but couldn't get it through the Senate. After that, Republicans, now in the majority, suddenly had very different views, as did the Democrats. You know, some of the very people that didn't allow nonpartisan redistricting reform to occur in the 2000s were now the people that were calling for that legislation in 2010. It's all about power. And that's the biggest problem.
I was going to say, we're not breaking any news, but as a reminder, in one word, this whole thing is about power. But I didn't even need to ask the question because you concluded.
That's what it is. And so it's amazing how people's perspectives have changed depending on what the current status of the legislature is. And that's why 2020 was an opportunity, because no one knew exactly what the census data was going to look like, which was going to force whether we were getting another seat, and if so, where the growth occurred. Moreover, no one knew who was going to be in charge. And so there was an opportunity there that has now passed.
Is the next reasonable opportunity in 2029 or 2030?
People that are more optimistic than me think, you know, that something can be done sooner. You know, I guess I'm jaded from my service in the General Assembly. I tend to think that the next opportunity will be sometime late in this decade.
During our conversation, former State House Representative Chuck McGrady mentioned Iowa several times as a potential beacon for redistricting reform. So, let's head to the Midwest.
I'm Katarina Sestarek, and I'm the state government reporter for Iowa Public Radio based in Des Moines.
A quick snapshot on the Hawkeye State before Katarina provides deeper context. Iowa is a red state, voted for Trump twice. Three of its four congressional seats belong to Republicans.
Iowa's current congressional districts are really drawn into almost like just four quadrants, four rectangles.
Conservatives hold comfortable majorities in both chambers of the legislature. The governor is a Republican, as is a majority of the state Supreme Court. Iowa has used a nonpartisan commission to draw its maps since 1980, so five times. However,
the proposed maps that were just rejected by the Iowa legislature actually made some kind of funkier shapes than what we currently have here.
Legislators recently voted against using the first draft of maps that the commission produced.
So this is an agency that does things like they draft bills, they look at, you know, potential legal issues or financial consequences of different legislation. So they're just the numbers and data people, and they actually draw the maps. And they have to follow a lot of rules when they're drawing those maps. They can't consider things like the voting patterns of people in any area. They can't consider the addresses of current lawmakers. They just have to really base it on population and keeping cities and counties as whole as they can when they're drawing districts.
So you just mentioned some of the things that cannot be used by the commission. What can be used?
They can use population numbers. They can use the standards of compactness, which is kind of the shape of the district. So Iowa law sets out, it specifies that like a square or a rectangle would be an ideal shape of a district. And so, for example, in congressional mapping, they can't break up counties. So all the counties have to remain whole on the congressional map. And then when they're drawing the smaller state legislative districts, they have to try to keep cities whole as much as possible and try to keep counties whole as much as possible as well.
And has that shielded the process from some or lots of litigation? Or is there still some or lots of litigation over redistricting in Iowa?
To this point, it really has shielded the process from litigation and, you know, even from partisanship. The legislature gets to vote to accept or reject the redistricting maps, but they can't amend the first and second rounds of maps. So that means that, you know, while obviously they can technically think about politics when they're deciding how to vote on the maps, they don't get to touch the maps until much later in the process in terms of amending them. So if the legislature rejects maps twice, they get to a third set of maps, which then the legislature can amend and then, you know, potentially gerrymander. But that has never happened. They have gotten to a third map that happened in 1981, but the legislature accepted that map without making changes to it.
What doesn't work about Iowa's system? If there's anything of note or if there are changes that have been made since 1980, 81, that first year of existence?
I think this is the year that we might see what's wrong with Iowa's system or what doesn't work, a loophole potentially. There have been concerns this year from Democrats that Republicans will just try to get to that third plan that they can then amend and then gerrymander it in their favor. This is something that Republicans have not committed to not doing. They won't really say, you know, what their plans are. They just keep saying, well, we haven't even seen the second map yet, so how can we say what we would do with the third map? No legislature in the past, since the system has started, has chosen to take it to that point. But at this point, there's no guarantee that this one won't do that.
Why did they say they rejected the first round of maps?
They said that they thought the compactness of some districts could be improved. There were some very irregularly shaped districts, some state legislative districts that, you know, they compared to a figure eight or to a salamander, just shapes that in Iowa people aren't really used to seeing. And they just sent it back to the Legislative Services Agency saying, you know, do better next time.
And was there any analysis? Had anyone gamed out, oh, you know, it's three Republican districts and one competitive, or this clearly would be 2-2? Or what was the forecast if there was one?
The forecast was one of the districts would remain a Republican stronghold. One would remain very competitive. One would get a bit more Republican, and then one would essentially become a Democratic stronghold. So that would kind of give, you know, probably in most years, a potential for a evenly split congressional delegation from Iowa. And again, right now we have three Republicans and one Democrat. But in 2018, we had three Democrats and one Republican. So it, you know, it's kind of changed.
I've heard independent. I've heard nonpartisan. How is it most frequently or most colloquially talked about in Iowa? Like, what is it known as?
Independent, fair, nonpartisan. I mean, those are all words that I've heard to describe it. And gold standard, that's a phrase people like to use a lot.
Yeah. To the extent you've gauged that, like, what do you make of that? Is that elected officials kind of blowing smoke, or is it the gold standard for this?
I think it really is. I mean, at least compared to most places, probably a better system in terms of just, you know, I think it's produced actually really competitive congressional districts, competitive legislative districts to some extent. So, yeah, I think nationally it actually is considered a good system.
So you signal that they rejected the first round of maps. Is there any discussion of rejecting this infrastructure itself? Republicans have all this power from the way you've laid it out. Are there any calls for, hey, we've done this for 40 years. It's time the legislative body took back the responsibility of doing this on our own?
Republicans keep saying that they want to follow Iowa Code Chapter 42, which is the part of the law here that sets out the current redistricting process. They really have not said, at least not publicly, anything about wanting to change the system. But again, if they can get to a third set of maps, they can change the maps how they want. And I'll say, too, that this is not the first time that the legislature has rejected the first redistricting plan. They've done it twice before. In 1981, they used the third map. And in 2001, they used the second map. So it's this, what's happening right now is not unprecedented.
Iowa has a commission that handles redistricting because of a lawsuit that dates back to the 1970s. California saw reform after citizens rallied, generated a constitutional referendum, and created a citizen process. In North Carolina, no such legal challenge has played out, and no such process for you, the people, is available to put forth a constitutional amendment. And it's worth the reminder, when you claim a political majority, there's a funny thing that happens about quieting your own calls for reform and the claims of unfairness.
And I think we need to remember, too, that the shoe has been on the other foot. It will be on the other foot again. The battle for independent, nonpartisan redistricting should be viewed as a nonpartisan fight, because the one thing we know about American politics is one party may be down now, they will be up in the future, and they will try to use the levers of power to maintain power.
Imagine a renowned chef turning over the reins to his or her kitchen, a pilot relinquishing the controls, or a NASCAR driver putting it in cruise control. Cooking, flying, driving, redistricting. It is central to what they do. And there better be a darn good reason or a serious problem for them to give up a fundamental lever of power. Next time on Behind the Lines.
No map is going to be considered by the committee, the redistricting committee, that hasn't been drawn in public view.
The time has come for lawmakers to draw new districts. State legislators are in the process of drawing districts across the state, congressional and legislative, and this time things look a little different.
So we're not going to go to a dark room and draw a map, and we don't even have an expert.
We'll bring you up to speed on the latest with the state's redistricting process. That's next Tuesday. This episode was produced by the talented Charlie Shelton Ormond. My name is Jeff Tiberi.